Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to News Crunch, a new monthly segment on At Home with Victoria. Join TV journalist and news lady Victoria Gaither, along with her smart, witty, and colorful guests, as they crunch newsmakers and stories while putting their own spin on issues. Here's Victoria.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight on At Home with Victoria. We had actually booked this show about a week and a half ago, but something came up and I had to reschedule. So I apologize to many of you who were interested in listening. But the topic of discussion tonight is Trayvon Martin. You cannot pick up a newspaper. You cannot look at your local news. You cannot look at national news, water cooler, social networking sites without everybody talking about the Trayvon Martin case. And since I'm such a news junkie, and my fellow journalists are too, of course, we decided that we were going to put our thoughts and comments in there as well and talk about the Trayvon Martin case. I also mentioned to our journalist that's joining us tonight, actually tonight, right now at 8 o'clock on Anderson Cooper 360 on CNN, George Zimmerman's attorney is scheduled to make an appearance on there tonight to talk to Anderson Cooper. So while we're having this discussion, I'll also have CNN on because I'm very much curious as to see what his lawyer is going to say. But with that said, our journalists that are joining us tonight, you guys already know them. So if you're a faithful listener to At Home with Victoria, Grover Merle has been on the show before. Grover is interesting because it seems like every single major news story ends up touching his news market down there in Florida. Grover has been here for the Whitney Houston. He's been here for Casey Anthony. And, Grover, now you're back for the Trayvon Martin story. So you guys just seem to be the hub of news down there.
You know, it's actually funny. Everyone says that every crazy story has a tie to Florida, and it seems to be true. So, it's definitely interesting down here. It's just the way that things are playing out just in our backyard. It's crazy.
I was going to say, well, and that craziness that you're talking about is something that we're going to talk about shortly, but I wanted to bring in journalist Nikki Mayo into the conversation. Nikki has also been on At Home with Victoria before, and the last time she was on the show, I think it was when we talked about the death of Whitney Houston. Nikki, thank you so much for coming back to the show for a second time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, Grover, I guess I want to start with you because I know you had mentioned to me via Facebook in some private conversations that you actually got a chance to speak with, was it Trayvon Martin's cousin or somebody in his family?
I talked to his cousin. She lives here in Tampa, but I actually got a chance to meet his parents. They were here last week for a rally. Well, not so much of a rally. It was more like a sit down with all the attorneys. The National Bar Association held a town hall meeting last Tuesday here in Tampa to discuss basically the case. And you know, his lawyer Crump was here. The parents' lawyer David Crump was here to talk about the case and what's next and what they've actually done so far and how much they're appreciative of the public's outcry behind this case.
You know, something that every single time I see his parents on the news, of course, you know, your heart just completely goes out to them. But I always wonder, and in the back of my mind, if his parents and his family really has had the opportunity to grieve that he's gone. Because there was a conversation on National Public Radio about the woman who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and that was as a result of her kid being killed by a drunk driver. So she had talked about how, you know, she really never had the time to grieve over her child being killed because she was sort of propelled into the national spotlight, and then she started that organization. So she... her advice was that, you know, it would be nice to give them some time, you know, for them to really grieve. So that always kind of is in the back of my head whenever I see them on the news is that, you know, I wonder if they really have had the time to grieve for their son, Trayvon. Nikki, we were talking before the show, and you were saying how this this entire case is just something that people just really, really, really want to talk about. Why do you think that is?
There's so many angles, and people are taking this opportunity to bring their certain platforms to the forefront. You could talk about gun rights. You can talk about racial profiling. You could talk about just the idea of youth versus adult. You know, at what point is a person an adult? Different organizations and different people have just pretty much piggybacked all over this whole case. There's music videos now dedicated to Trayvon. There's a slogan. At one point, the family even wanted to trademark the I Am Trayvon, that line alone. So there's so many different things that you can talk about. The lawyers, the fact that the lawyers have been swapped out as Zimmerman alone, that's been interesting, that he had a website up and you couldn't find the guy. This is like such a CSI / you know, if you like that court TV feel, this is all over it. This is what people live for. And there's just so many things to talk about.
Yeah, and you're right there. There are so many different angles. And as I mentioned at the top of the show that I also had CNN on because of George Zimmerman's attorney is supposed to talk to Anderson. But we do know that George Zimmerman raised over $200,000 for his defense. I don't know if you guys remember real quick when he had a website up and then it stayed up, I think, for all of a couple of days or maybe shorter than that. And then the website was taken down. But it's interesting that in that short period of time that he was able to raise, according to him and his lawyer, over $200,000 online for his defense. Grover, what do you make of that? I mean, obviously, for that to happen, he certainly does have his supporters out there as well.
He definitely does have his supporters out there. And you know, it's there's always the counter supporters that we see since we've had so many rallies, you know, There's been tons and tons of rallies here in Tampa and also in Sanford where this happened. And, you know, actually when I went to Sanford about, I would say, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, you can actually see, like, there's this divide of Trayvon Martin supporters and George Zimmerman supporters. And it's just amazing to see the support that Zimmerman has, even though he may be the actual killer of Trayvon Martin. He still has the support group around him that actually the folks really do support his decision and what he did, even though it may or may not have been correct or the right thing to do. We will never know that, it's just amazing to see that.
Well, and Nikki, something too that I was struck by myself and actually watching all of this sort of unfold is that, you know, just the mobilization of people not only around the U.S. but around the world that went online to sign that petition to have George Zimmerman arrested. I think it was over 2 million people. Last number that I checked, you know, earlier during this incident, that many people mobilized to sort of make something like this happen. And, of course, your folks on Trayvon Martin's side are saying, well, you know, if it wasn't a result of things like that and, you know, them getting national attention for this story, then nothing would have ever happened and nobody would have never known anything about it and it would have been brushed under the rug and it sort of would be over by now.
I mean, the reality is knowing that there are many Trayvon Martin-style cases. I mean, Sanford Police Force is not a huge police precinct. No one knew where it was at unless you ever flew into that random airport that's over there. It's not Orlando. It's about a good 30-some-odd minutes away. So this could have happened at any small little juncture. And the whole what he profiled thing, people related to that. The whole, what is this guy doing with a gun? Again, people related to that. So that petition filled up for so many reasons because so many people had a reason to feel very uncomfortable about the fact that we have a 17-year-old young man and he's now gone. You have a 28-year-old man who was, for some reason, allowed to be questioned and then let go, and that struck a nerve with a lot of the audience, a lot of the public, because they were wondering, well, how is it that someone shot somebody and they're not at least locked up? So that's when we all started learning about the Stand Your Ground. I don't think any of my friends knew about the Stand Your Ground law for, you know, until it just popped up. So then you start reading about it, and then you're even finding out that avid gun supporters are not backing the whole Stand Your Ground. No, they're backing the Stand Your Ground law. They're just backing it in this case because it was so questionable. This case didn't become very popular until those 911 tapes came up, because Trayvon was shot back in February. We're starting to hear about it about a month later.
The date that that the fatal shooting took place was February the 26th. Was when it happened. And, you know, it's interesting you talk about the Stand Your Ground law when you said that none of your friends and nobody heard about it. You know, even as a journalist, I didn't know anything about the Stand Your Ground law either. So I think it was, you know, probably safe to say, you know, a large majority of Americans didn't know anything about the Stand Your Law ground. So I guess, you know, if you want to look at some positive things that can come out of a situation, it is interesting that now that will be, you know, is being called into question, and people that do have that in their areas and jurisdictions are now going to be looking at that, saying, hey, you know, wait a minute. But what is interesting about it was that the gentleman in Florida, the lawmaker who kind of put it forth, it's funny because I felt so bad for him on one interview. He came forth and he was like, look, you know, this was not my intent. When, you know, we came up with this law, it wasn't that you can, you know, do this to somebody and just sort of not deal with the repercussions and you get to go home. So I thought it was interesting how he was really, really making that, wanted to really make that clear. But just to give you guys just a little background, and Nikki started to talk about it. So the shooting itself happened on, February the 26th. And Trayvon was 17 years old, and he was unarmed. Again, George Zimmerman's 28, and he was the community watch coordinator for that gated community. Apparently, Trayvon was there visiting his father and his father's fiance. According to Zimmerman, from what he told police, Trayvon actually attacked him, and Trayvon was actually shot close range in the chest. So that just gives you a little background information on what happened. And Grover, I wanted to ask you this, because I, as a journalist, have been, and Nikki, you probably have too, I've been in many, many situations as a journalist and covering these sort of hot-button topics. And when you're a journalist there, I mean, you can really feel the divide between people. So whether it's an issue that people are saying is based on race, whether it's an issue that's, you know, based on men and women, or whether it's an issue based on, you know, abortion and anti-abortion, as a journalist, sometimes you really can be a little uncomfortable when you're in those situations, because people can have this sort of misdirected anger, and sometimes they can really take that out on you. I mean, I remember when the Tea Party stuff was going on, and I was in D.C., just kind of covering it for At Home with Victoria, and I remember there were many, many people within the Tea Party that, you know, were saying a lot of mean things and shouting at me. So it is interesting, even as a journalist, that you know, that's a part of our job, and we get it, and we go through it. But, I mean, Grover, it can be kind of weird and scary, in a sense, when you have to face that, right?
Yeah, you know, it definitely is. It's We've covered so many press conferences. We've been to so many press conferences here. We've been to the rallies, and we've been to pretty much everything that surrounded this case. You know, it's amazing, because we've actually had to put when we do go to the rallies, we have to have team coverage, meaning that we have to have two reporters there, three photographers, just to ensure that the reporters are safe during these rallies. And every time you take the press conference live, we'll have folks calling in, you know, saying, I don't understand why you guys are covering this story. And some of them are just irate with the whole situation. I was telling you, Victoria, a couple weeks ago, I had this viewer that called in, and she was actually really upset that we were airing the first rally that his parents held, along with Reverend Al Sharpton and a few other folks. And she called in. She was really, really upset about it. And she's like, I don't understand why you guys are playing this. It doesn't make sense. The kid was killed. And I said, well, ma'am, you know, we have to show both sides of the story, even though it may be a whole press conference. And then, you know, I explained to her how journalism actually is and how our station works. And, you know, she basically said, oh, you must be one of them. And, you know, it threw me back for a little bit. And I had to just sit down and think, okay, well, how will I handle this person on the phone, this viewer? So it makes you understand and realize there still is a divide in this country. It may be here in Florida, it may be anywhere in the nation, that folks still aren't happy with the outcome of this case.
But the divide is so weird to me, because once we establish that Zimmerman is not an Anglo, like he's not a white guy that shot him, he's actually of Latin descent, then it kind of pulled away from that. It's weird how the conversation went automatically to black, white. It made you almost think about the OJ situation, and it split rooms down the middle. And really, this should not be something that split rooms down the middle. I think I left out that I worked on a project where we talked with Trayvon Martin's parents, and we also talked to the mothers of Amadou Diallo and the fiance of Sean Bell within the last like couple weeks. It's going to be on TV once, like on Sunday. And when we were talking to these people, it shouldn't be a profiling situation, but it has become one. But you have mothers that are speaking up and saying, just period, if you were to kill my child because you thought he was suspicious, black, white, Puerto Rican, Asian, whatever, they're going to be very upset for obvious reasons. So I don't understand why there's that obvious racial divide. And, you know, you guys both know I work down in Florida. And, Florida, Tennessee, you know, it could happen in Baltimore. People are going to have a little twinge of how they really feel about the whole profiling situation. Some people are really in sync with it, to the point where they'll make a comment to a Grover like, oh, you must be one of those or one of them. That should not have a bearing on it. If you're a journalist, you're dealing with a news organization, then you're telling the story. You're not sitting there pontificating, you know, you're not an activist. That's not your job.
Right.
Your job is to tell the story. And they should always see that you're going to give an unbiased, here's the facts, here's what happened. We can sit here and do an analysis of what we've seen as journalists, but it does become a little bewildering when it seems like our audience is thinking that, okay, because you're a black male, you're definitely going to stand with the Trayvon Martin side.
Right.
Maybe you're into vigilante justice. Maybe you think the Zimmerman did it correctly. I don't know. But that's the idea. It's like there should be some space there that, no, our job is just to tell you what happened and give you the play-by-play.
Exactly.
Right. Well, and you know, the problem with that, and you know, the problem that I have to say, the problem that we do have with that is I think some of it is sort of self-imposed in our own industry, and that is because, you know, back in the day, and Grover, we've talked about this many times before, back in the day, you know, when I went to school to be a journalist, you know, it really was about your who, what, when, where, why, and getting the facts. I mean, nobody cared about what Victoria thought. Nobody cared about what this person thought. I mean, nobody really cared. It's like, listen, lady, just give me the information and read the news so I can go on about my day. And truth be told, I really just want to know what the weather is. So I wish you'd be quiet. That's a whole other different story. But but I mean, now, you know, with the advent of social networking and cable television and digital television, you've got all of these different news channels now that's got to fill the time with something. So that line, I think for us, for what the public's perception is, has really been crossed between, is this really, you know, Victoria Grover and Nikki who has the hat on as a journalist and is covering this, or is this, you know, Victoria, Nikki, and Grover, who is kind of putting their own spin on it in terms of what they think? And that's a whole other conversation, but I just threw that out there.
You have to walk that fine line as, you know, in so many cases that you're so compassionate about, and you always have to remember, okay, well, you have to remember the ethics in journalism. And, you know, there's folks in our newsroom that forget the ethics side of their job, and that's in every business or every newsroom, and you just have to remember, well, I'm here to report the facts, I'm here to tell the story, I'm here to do what I'm supposed to do, and make sure that our viewers are well informed and educated, and what they're supposed to know about the story. As long as we have the information, we'll share it with our viewers. But it's amazing to see that that ethics in journalism sometimes is out the window when it comes to certain stories. And I know you're absolutely right. That's a different topic. But with this case, you definitely see that divide.
Well, you know what confused a lot of people was when, since we have our pundits on the same stations as we have our news, our journalists, I get
exactly.
It's confusing. It doesn't help when you had the whole hoodie parade going on one of the networks. So it's like, okay, now I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
right.
had pundits wearing hoodies, and in some cases you had people who you knew were supposed to be the objective journalists still wearing hoodies too. So it's very confusing
right.
to the naked eye. You're like, well, you're supposed to give it to me, you know, balanced, no bias. Why am I seeing you take a side? It doesn't
right.
help. In some cases, you actually had the pundits standing with the family. So
exactly.
the question is, okay, is Zimmerman's camp ever going to feel comfortable coming on your network if you have your personalities and your people standing
mm-hmm.
alongside part of the story? You have to separate yourself from the story. I do the PSA
okay.
as much as I can to tell people, look, it's not my job to tell you how to feel. It's just my job to present you with the information.
Right, and then you make
but
the
it
decision.
Does get confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's
yeah,
confusing
absolutely.
When
yeah.
you see too many opinions coming out there. Like, I'm not sure what Geraldo Rivera really does, but when he made the hoodie comment, it was just like Chernobyl. Everybody wanted
right.
to get away from that guy so fast.
He even said that his son, which I thought was interesting, he even said that
mm-hmm.
His son was very upset with him and told him, I'm paraphrasing, you know, something like that. That's the most boneheaded or stupid thing that I have ever heard you say. So, but yeah, it is, you know, it is interesting. But I kind of just threw that out there, I guess, for, you know, me trying to look for a reasoning for why, you know, the general public would actually feel that way. I want to just, this is more of some thoughts, emails that we are getting in as we have this conversation about the shooting of
mm-hmm.
Trayvon Martin. This is a young lady from New York, and she said, Victoria, and yes, that she was surprised by what she saw when she saw the real George Zimmerman in court and his mugshot versus the pictures that were circulated in the media before. So I guess
mm-hmm.
she's talking about, you know, he was definitely looks like a couple of sizes smaller than the pictures that we were actually seeing. And, you know, I don't really know, you know, I imagine Glover and Nikki, the stress of those months of going through something like this, that can take a bit of weight off of you, I'm sure.
Oh, no.
And
I
you know,
that mugshot's from, like, 2005.
Yeah,
it's
and
like,
you know, like, our newsroom.
And pictures. Yeah.
Our newsroom definitely took a hit. Every newsroom definitely took a hit because we were given pictures that were older pictures from, you know, years ago. And, you know, the viewers were calling in, well, why are you showing older pictures of Trayvon and George Zimmerman at that age? Why don't you guys use the new pictures? And those are the pictures that we were given at the time, at the start of the case.
Yeah.
Since then, you know, everything is updated and newer photos have been distributed by the AP. But, you know, it's still the fact that we still have to use the same pictures that were given. And that was the sticking point of this whole entire case. Why are we using old pictures? And that they came up in every meeting that we had in our newsroom. And it was just something that we had to use and,
right.
and go through. Now that we have the new mugshot of George Zimmerman and his family has circulated newer photos of Trayvon, that's what you will begin to see, newer photos of those two and what they look like present day.
Yeah, but I still imagine, too, because I, you know, when the new photos came out, I still would imagine, too, that, you know, if you're a person going through something like this, what, February, March, April, that still, and, you know, he may not have lost a lot of weight, but I imagine the stress and the pressure of sort of being in hiding and fearful for your life and, you know,
yeah,
hanging out in one room, that alone, that kind of stress will, you know, probably can take some weight off of you. And this is more of a comment from a young lady in New Jersey, and she says,
mm-hmm,
note, I want to say up front that I am an African-American woman and I do have kids. And she says, for some reason, nobody will never really know what happened that night except for George and Trayvon. Unfortunately, Trayvon is no longer with us. She says that she just thinks that George really did not mean to kill Trayvon, and she looks at it as a unfortunate incident where you had two people that collided, and that was the result. So I thought that was interesting.
A lot of people feel that way, but the question is, why did he have a firearm on him?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question that keeps being popped up is like, you know, we've all listened to the 911 call, and I listened to the unedited one, so you kind of hear, you know, he's walking and everything like that. And that's the question is, like, what happened while he was walking? Like, did Trayvon come out the bushes? You know, what exactly happened? And that's the part that we're going to always try to dissect. But that's where the gun control question starts coming in and the whole stand your ground law questions come in. Why did he have a firearm on him when he went walking toward or after this teen?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe
he
didn't mean to kill him, but he had a gun on him.
We today there was a meeting with Mark O'Hara at the Tiger Bay Foundation. Nikki, you probably know all about Tiger Bay from being working in Sarasota. Pretty much, he was questioning his own defense and saying that, you know, they may not even use stand your ground in this case because they don't really know all the facts that the state has in their back pocket, so to speak. So I think on tomorrow there's another hearing. But the interesting key fact is that on May 1st in Tallahassee, the governor is actually going to be sitting down with his task force that he created, and we'll have the task force to review the Stand Your Ground statute. And that will be the first meeting that they've had since that task force has been created. To figure out what's next steps. Do they need to get rid of this law? Do they need to change it and make it more specific? Because it's just a broad law that they have, and it doesn't specify when you can use your handgun in a stand your ground defense. And there's plenty of cases that we have going on right now, that I know so far, that they're using stand your ground, and it just doesn't make sense. But here, it's just basically, if you feel threatened, you can shoot and kill someone. So, it's just interesting.
Right. You know, here in Maryland, we have our own parallel,
too. I think you guys
too.
Are right. I mean, there, you know, you can kind of look at this case, and there's so many different angles that
mm-hmm.
you can dissect this from. This is, again, more of a response from a listener right now in Prince George's County in Maryland, and she says that she actually believes that she has little faith, and she believes that George Zimmerman is actually going to go free. She talks about his new attorney, Mark O'Mara, says that he is a pit bull, and we talked a little bit about this before the show as well, and that he actually seemed, in her opinion, to really have his stuff together in that short exchange than she thought the prosecution did.
Well, he's definitely your go-to guy if you get in trouble in Central Florida. That's without saying. And she has a good point. He's going to be able to make a good argument, and Trayvon's not here to talk, so you're going to have to rely off a witness account. And as we saw the initial, I think, the bond hearing or something like that, whatever we're calling it, folks are afraid to take the stand in this case. I mean, this is a very volatile situation, and no one wants their face associated with this. So finding people to speak out on this is going to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Seriously tough.
Yeah.
You're going to have to go off of what you think happened in a lot of these cases when this stuff starts to go really to trial. There's a good chance. There really is. And he can always claim, you know, he does have a gash in the back of his head. He does have a broken nose. So he can't claim that he was assaulted to the point where he feared for his life.
Right, right. My producer, Marilyn Bennett, apparently there are a few guests or people that are interested in calling in and having their thoughts and their things that they want to say. I told it would be great if you guys can actually call in maybe after 8:45, because right now a friend of mine, who's a D.C. detective, Mitch Cradle, has actually been on the show before. And Grover and Nikki, I thought it would be kind of interesting to have Mitch on from a perspective that he's a police officer, because then I remember there were all these questions sort of surrounding, well, you know, if I am a sort of average citizen and I encounter somebody with a gun, you know, sort of individual rights started to come to my mind. Well, you know, what would happen if somebody came up and I felt like they were, you know, going to threaten me? So I asked Mitch if he would call in and perhaps just kind of talk to us and give us his thoughts on this. I think he's on the line, so let's see if we can bring Mitch into the conversation. Mitch, are you with us?
Yes, hello. How you doing?
Great. Nikki and Grover are also here on the line as well. I know you probably have your many thoughts and things about the whole Trayvon Martin case, but I wanted to bring you on from a perspective that in law enforcement, you know, in terms of rights that ordinary citizens have, let's say, for example, I'm out in the street or, you know, walking around and somebody comes to attack me. I mean, you know, as a citizen, you would think that you would have the right to defend yourself, right?
Yes.
Now, in the whole Trayvon Martin case, if you were talking to a group of young men, especially African-American men, because I know in D.C. you do a lot of work in the community, have you talked about this to them and giving them sort of any type of advice on, you know, what to do in certain situations?
Well, Victoria, for years I've always done, you know, a great deal of volunteer work in a community that is based, you know, with a bunch of young African-American males. And on occasions, I mean, we're talking 20 years plus, but I've always had conversations with them in reference to, you know, when they're stopped by the police or when they're approached by authority figures or even adults. So, you know, for what to just happen is very tragic. But the advice that I've always given the young guys, even matter of fact, even my sons, I have a son, sons who are now 18 and 20 years old, and I've always told them when approached by police to, you know, listen, give them respect. The police are, you know, they are the authority in that particular situation. So just listen. Even if, you know, you have an attitude where you don't trust police, you don't like the police, you know, because a lot of them express those type of feelings throughout the years. But, I've always told them just, you know, obey the commands. They're not going to do anything to you that's going to hurt you. Just listen and don't come with an aggressive type attitude, because that sort of, I would say, make things a little much more aggressive on both ends, and the police officers more than likely is going to react that way. So I basically always try to tell them to stay calm, and there's nothing wrong with asking questions on why you're being stopped, what's going on, but just ask in a respectful way as if you're talking to your parent, and don't be combative with the police officer. And that, you know, that the situation, which may sometimes turn out to be very long, could be very short, but just, you know, just being respectful on both ends.
Right. Nikki, did you have anything you wanted to ask Mitch?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was a lot of stories about having that conversation with your young men. One of the things I noticed with the panel that we had a couple weeks ago about this whole situation was some of the parents that were not parents of Black or Latino didn't understand why did we have to have that conversation with our kids. Why didn't we just, why wasn't it just understood that if they were not in the wrong, they didn't have to, you know, like you said, bow back? How do you explain that to parents that don't have to worry about their kids being profiled regularly?
I can barely hear you. Say that, asking that question again, please.
How do you explain the talk that you have with your son? You know, the talk about how to act with, in any event that you're with a police officer and, you know, they're trying to interrogate you, ask you questions and the like. The same conversation you just described, how do you explain that to parents that maybe they don't have to, frankly, worry about their kids being profiled?
Well, it's by you mentioning that, a great deal of the kids that I've talked to, I've had to deal with their parents as well, because they also had some of the concerns, because some issues came up in reference to police officers harassing a bunch of young black males that were hanging out on the corner, not committing crimes. And, as you know, like I explained to them, is that it's just a matter of just having an understanding, because as myself as growing up, we used to get harassed by police all the time, and we were very combative. Matter of fact, we used to run when the police come just to have fun, and a lot of the situations turned out to be pretty bad. And as I got older, I learned that all the police really want is respect. And I try to tell the parents is that you want police officers questioning, you know, kids in your neighborhoods. You want them getting out the cars, knowing who's in your community. You want them doing that because you want them doing their job. You don't want police officers riding in cars and not getting out their cars. You want them to know the neighborhood, because when something is going on, police have to know what's going on. But police officer standing in a car, he's not doing his job. So I welcome that. I wouldn't say an intrusion, but I welcome the police questioning, even stopping me, because if they're doing their job, that's what they're supposed to do. And
I'm curious
I try to explain it in a situation where it's helping the community and not necessarily an harassment thing.
Well, police officers wear uniforms, so what do you do how do you tell young people about dealing with the vigilante justice people of the world, the neighborhood watch people? Because, I mean, that's what Zimmerman
that's
did.
Tough.
He was a neighborhood
yeah.
watch person. And then also here in Baltimore, we have the case over here near Pikesville in Baltimore City, where you had two young, they happen to be Orthodox Jewish guys. They're in trial right now for assaulting a young teenager, happened to be black, with ham radios. I mean, it's the same neighborhood watch thing over and again. Like, do they stop for the neighborhood watch guy, too? How does that work?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know. Neighborhood watch are just citizens. I don't know why they would want to consider themselves more than just citizens. And I've told some of the young guys up in the neighborhoods, when they are approached by what we call D.C., used to be called orange hats. And I always tell them, when you're approached by orange hats, a lot of the orange hats are just people in your community just trying to help you keep your community safe. And when they come to you, I mean, just be respectful and,
gotcha.
You know, not necessarily be combative with them as well. See, every situation I try to explain it where it is the better good for everyone. And in this
right.
particular situation, it is always the community. So a lot of times the young guys that I talk to, I'm talking mm-hmm. to them the way I'm talking to you all now. I'm being very honest, and it's being related to them because it's coming from someone who they respect. See, a lot of times with young people, it's a matter of who they're getting information from, because they're getting it from
sure.
someone who's been in the same community with them. And by me always coming back to my old community and doing a great deal of community service with them, I'm always buying them band equipment, giving them money for uniforms. I'm always doing things. So whatever I tell them and the things I relate to them, they understand. And in some of the other communities, if more of that was done, a lot of the young kids will understand that the orange hats, the community people, the guardian angels, they're just people trying to help them opposed to people trying to hurt them.
Yeah, but you know, what's interesting about that whole thing, Ms. Nikki and Grover, I remember when I was a reporter in the Midwest, and it was sort of one of those guardian angel groups or, you know, something like that. They actually came to town. I can't remember what happened, but they ended up coming to town to help patrol a neighborhood or something. And I just remember a lot of people who lived there were very upset that you had these sort of outsiders and the quote-unquote, they call them fake cops, you know, come into their community
exactly.
to try to control their communities. So I think in most neighborhoods across America, there's already this sort of mistrust a little bit. I don't know if mistrust is the word between sort of whether it's a neighborhood group or whatever, because, you know, in a real citizen mind, like, I just think, oh, you're not real, so what are you trying to tell me what to do? It's not like you're a real police officer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when you go to the mall and you see the police officers at the mall, you know, you kind of think, oh, well, I mean, you're not like a real police officer, you're just a mall cop. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think in maybe sort of your average American mind, no matter what community or state you live in, most people kind of think that about, you know, citizen patrols anyway. So, you know, if you get a situation like where you had somebody like George Zimmerman who had a gun and it turns into a volatile situation, then that just, you know, obviously just magnifies that whole thing 10 times and makes it 100 times worse.
Exactly. And I totally agree. And even though I don't know exactly what happened in that situation, but something occurred whereas someone was more aggressive than the other for it to occur the way it did. Something has to have happened. And like I said, I don't want to speak on that because they have, you know, they're dealing with it in court and everything. But I remember years ago in Clifton Terrace, the Muslims, they were guards in a particular drug complex, which was very bad as far as when the crack epidemic was high. And the young guys around there were selling all the drugs, used to shoot at the Muslims in their booths. They used to do all kinds of things because a lot of the Muslims, they were very aggressive with them guys in the neighborhood. So they came into their community with an aggressive attitude, and it caused a lot of problems. And I would suggest people who are outside of a neighborhood, you cannot just go into anyone's neighborhood and just be aggressive towards the way living was already, you know, going on right away. It's no different than being a substitute teacher. You've been a substitute teacher, you come into the classroom, you throw on all kinds of demands when here it is for the past 90 days or past 2-3 years, the kids were being taught a different way, but you come in with your rules. Sometimes adapting to an environment has to come from the adult opposed to coming to the kids adapting to the adult. So my approach is always I adapt to the environment, I adapt to the kids, I adapt to whatever they're used to, then I slowly implement some changes I will want to make.
And Grover and Nikki, I have to tell you when you just said substitution teachers, I remember being in school, and my goodness, we would love when our teacher was out and a substitute came because we felt like we could completely run that teacher. Like, we could tell them what to do. I mean, I know looking back on it now, you know, we were an absolute mess, and there was really no reason to be that way. But that brought back memories because you're right. You know, when you're a substitute teacher, I mean, most of the time, either one or two things happen. Either you come in there with an iron fist and, you know, you're just right out mean and all the kids just don't like you, or you come in there and you're a pleaser and you just let the kids run rampant and get their way. So I thought that's a really good analogy with that. Grover, do you have any thoughts or thinking anything as Mitch is discussing this?
No, actually, I thought he said it very well. Those are the questions that I had, too, that Nikki brought up. But those were the ones that were burning in the back of my head. How do you actually teach black children, or, you know, they don't even have to be black, they can be, you know, any type of race that has neighborhood watches. I guess my question that I have is that, do you think that maybe having a law enforcement background, do you think that now, since the standing ground law has been brought to light, do you think that since, if there were ever to be another shooting in a gated neighborhood, and it's, you know, a police or a law, or I guess like a law enforcement officer or basically a neighborhood watch, and they do shoot that person, do you think that case would be looked at differently? Or do you think any type of aggressive shooting, even though all shootings are aggressive, but I'm pretty much any violent shooting that happens, do you think that would be looked at differently now that this case has been brought to light?
I mean, even here in D.C., we've had situations where police officers have shot kids. We had one recently in Southeast, maybe within the last few years or two, police officers had shot a young kid, and a lot of people, especially in the community, had rushed to judgment, you know, against the police officers, and a lot of negative things were said, but at the end of the investigation, the police officers were justified, and a gun was actually found in the home of the gun that was used to shoot at the police officer was actually found. So what happens is whenever things occur, sometimes it only takes one person in the community to stir things up, and then that just everything just falls right behind it, opposed to waiting. You know, people don't, when it comes to aggression and shootings, people don't have the patience to wait for the investigations to occur. I've been investigating homicides for a year, and I always tell, you know, family members, you know, I can't really, you know, feel your pain the way you do, but I just ask them to be patient because investigations take long. I would rather for an investigation to take long and thorough opposed to being quick and sloppy. But, of course, citizens, they jump the gun on aggression, and all, like I say, all it takes is one person to get it started.
Right. Well, Mitch, listen, thank you so much for calling in. I always appreciate your thoughts and your comments, and if anybody wants to kind of keep up with Mitch, besides being a fantastic detective with the D.C. Police Department, he does a lot of community work. Actually, Mitch, before you go, are you working on any other video shoots or video presentations that's online yet on the on YouTube?
Well, I had to. I was working on one project online on YouTube. I had to slow down because, fortunately, it was noticed by someone, and now we're shooting it for a TV pilot, and we'll be shooting it for a TV series that's starting this summer.
Awesome. Okay, great. Well, when that happens, then I already know that I'm going to be the first journalist that you'll give the interview to. So that's
most definitely. Most definitely.
Say hi to all our friends in the D.C. Police Department. Thank you so much, as always, for taking the time and calling into the show.
You're welcome. You all take it easy. Good night.
And, again, that was Mitch Cradle. Mitch is a longtime detective with the D.C. Police Department. And from time to time when we have issues like this or things like this, I always like to invite Mitch because he really is somebody who's out there on the forefront. But, Nikki, you know what was interesting when we were talking about the whole, you know, sort of neighborhood watch people? Like, I think about my own community, and I think about, like, there is no neighborhood watch in my community. You know, you kind of have your neighbors, and they kind of watch out. You know, they kind of watch out for you. So, like, if I leave or go somewhere or, you know, I always, you know, walk down and tell my neighbor, hey, I'm going to be gone for a couple of days. So that's kind of how we do it in my community. But I think the other thing, part with George Zimmerman, what was scary about him, too, was that he was actually in college studying criminal justice and wanted apparently to be in law enforcement or to be a police officer. So that in itself scared a lot of people.
Well, think about it. You have a period where you're green at anything. He was in college studying something. Maybe he was 28, but he was still studying and learning this. I kept telling one of my friends, I said, just from the professional standpoint and being an adult, there are only a handful of people in this nation that have to let you hurt them before they hurt you back. And I don't know if Zimmerman had gotten to that point where he realized that. I mean, that handful of people are people in real law enforcement. People who went through somebody's academy or had some type of formal training, military, I'll include them in that too. Otherwise, if you go and attempt to follow somebody or, you know, accost somebody, or if you are the aggressor in it, no one's required to just sit there and look at you. So there's a good chance that you might anger the subject and they may retaliate. So it's kind of like you don't go poking somebody with a stick and then wonder why they turn around and do something negative to you.
Right.
So that's, while he wanted to be a law enforcement officer, he wasn't quite there yet. And that green period that most of us have, that rookie season, he hasn't quite had it yet.
Right, absolutely. You know, of course, and when something like this happened, Grover, you know, like I'm the type of person, not even as a journalist, you know, I try to put myself or somebody in my family in that situation to think, you know, sort of what would I do or how would I react. And I just feel like, you know, knowing myself, I just feel like if I were somewhere and somebody was following me or said something to me, I know with my personality, I'm the type of person who's going to say, do you have a problem? I mean, is there something wrong? What's the problem? Why are you following me? So I just think about that and think about the situation where I've heard critics say, well, you know, Trayvon attacked him. And then it's funny because I remember thinking to myself, well, hell, if somebody came and tried to attack me or do something to me, I'm just not going to sit there and let them do something to me. Now, you know, whether you decide to run or whether you decide to defend yourself or whatever, you know, it would just completely make sense that if somebody is trying to attack you, then you're going to, you know, you're going to want to do something back.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're clear-cut authority figures. You know, he said that your friend Mitch said that they're the orange hats in Washington, D.C. Okay, that's a commonly understood authority figure in a community. They're not law enforcement, but there's an understanding that they're there to help you. Unless we find out that this person, George Zimmerman, had a jacket on, it's a neighborhood watch across it, or
right,
he had
right.
a shield or something indicating you are an authority figure, then he's just a regular Joe Blow, 28-year-old, I don't know how much he weighed, guy that's following you. Until he has some identifier on him, a plaque on the side of the car, it's just a guy that's following you.
Yep.
And to that, you don't automatically just give him authority. I did want us to possibly talk about the question of age.
Mm-hmm.
Of age, because I've had this discussion like once a week since this happened. I'm sorry, I have an echo. And the thing is that I've had people say that, well, just because he was 17 does not mean that he was a child.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess legally, if you want to go by what the law says, you know, what is it, the age of 18, you're considered an adult. So, you know, technically, if you want to go by what the law says, I guess he really was still considered a child. I don't know, Grover, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I don't really know. That's a hard question to ask. I feel as though that he's still at 17. I would still think that you're not really able to depend on yourself or to be a dependent. So yeah, I would definitely think that he was still a child. He was still going to school. But yeah, that's a big question that's come up a lot in the past.
Because according
to
Florida Bar, 18 is an adult. Period. But it's the idea
that
he had the same mental capacity as a 28-year-old. Like to hear that, you know, this kid, this teen should have made some sense of it all and maybe not have made these decisions. When's the last time you talked to a 17-year-old? They're not known for making the best decisions.
And, in fact, Gina, who's listening to us tonight from California, she is a registered nurse. So, Gina, if you are listening, I know you are very passionate about this subject, so the lines are open. So I want you to call in and you know, kind of tell me what you think. But Gina says, well, I beg to differ. He was in an emotional situation talking about Trayvon where he was vulnerable in a situation crisis as it is, in my opinion, as a RN, that he was a child at that time. So she's saying that I don't care, hey, if, you know, he was 17, at 17, she still considers that to be a child. So, Gina, why don't you call in, and if you do call in, just give me the last four digits of your telephone number so I know that that is you on the board. And if any of you want to call in, I know, I don't know if Sandy is still with us from Nebraska, if any of you guys want to call in and just sort of give us your thoughts and your comments, whether you support George Zimmerman, whether you don't, whether you support Trayvon or whether you don't. We're open to listening to everything. We are equal opportunity show here. So, you know, I want you to feel like, you know, you can say what it is that you want to say and how you want to feel. So the lines are open, 718-664-9364. Again, 718-664-9364. Grover, let me ask you this. When you had the conversation with, was it his cousin, what is it that you guys talked about? What was the conversation,
you know,
like?
We talked about the case, and it was still fresh. It was back in the early part of March when the news first broke that there was this kid that was shot by a neighborhood watch captain or watch volunteer. And, you know, she just didn't understand. You know, it was just so fresh to the whole family. And that the whole public outcry started about, you know, that he needed to be arrested, which she felt as though needed to happen. There wasn't a full arrest done. And that's what she really honed in on, is that she felt as though that there wasn't a full, she didn't believe in the justice system, that it wasn't working, because her nephew was shot and killed, and the shooter wasn't arrested. He was brought in for questioning and then later released. And that's not usually how things work. But if you usually, here in Florida, if you claim stand your ground, that's pretty much what happens, that they bring you in for questioning if they want to, if the law enforcement wants to, and then you leave after that, or you just, you know, just stay home. But that's her main, that was her main concern, is that, and that's what his parents' main concern was that there wasn't, justice wasn't being done for Trayvon, according to them.
Speaking, Grover, just hold on 1 second, because I've got Gina on the line, and she's been holding on for a while. Gina is listening and a faithful fan of At Home with Victoria. She's a registered nurse, and she is joining us tonight from the lovely state of California. Gina, are you with us?
Yes. Hi. Good evening.
Hey, love. Thanks so much for being here. So I know you're super passionate about this, so get tell Nikki and Grover and I your thoughts, because I know you've really been following this case.
My thoughts are, regardless, there's all different, of course, people have different abstract ways of thinking, and they want to look at this from all different angles, and to be able to appeal to people in the nation that are around the world that have expressed various opinions and are very upset about this child that has been murdered, who was walking home, as any of our children may do, at a reasonable time of the early day, evening. And, you know, how many times did we or our children say that they're going to go and get some candy or something? They have their routine, and then they come home. And he's not supposed to, you're supposed to be able to count on the adults around you to protect you and not to kill you. And this is a part of a stage of development, initially very young, young children and infants, for example. They develop their initial abilities to trust because they have their parents. And these things go in stages, and this is how we grow and develop into the people that we are, as these things are completed throughout our different growth phases. So naturally, regardless if his 17-year-old young man is coping skills are that when you are in, he was presented with, in his normal environment, on his way home, doing something in his comfort zone, exercising a little independence as a young adult. But when he's faced with a life threatening, immediately his life is being threatened by a man that is pursuing him with a weapon, and he has no one at all to protect him. And this is just extremely concerning in the United States of America, that that a young man was killed in this manner. It's very upsetting.
Well, and Gina, I know that by profession, you're an RN, so, you know, you get to see, and you've seen a lot of crazy things working in emergency rooms and hospitals and stuff all your lifetime. But you know about child development, because all that stuff is what you do. But getting back to the question of whether he was 17 or 18, do you still consider 17 to be a child as opposed to an adult?
Yeah. When he had to reach in to be able to have a coping mechanism for that, when that was presented to him, that his life was threatened by a man pursuing him, certainly something he was not on guard for. He was not running with a gang. He wasn't in that, you know, he's just walking home, and he was being pursued by an adult with a weapon. So he was not, he doesn't, did not, does not at his age have the skills to reach in and pull out what to do in that situation, and he was completely, you know, left without anyone to protect him. So at that time, he is a child. He does not have the tools in his toolbox for that type of threat, other than hopefully if he was able to defend himself at all, which I don't know. But other than just in sheer, you know, automatic response, but other tools as far as being able to make a split-second decision, he doesn't have that, those tools, because that's where then he would still need an adult to protect him.
And, you know, guys, I'm thinking about something, Gina, as you talk about this and have the tools. Like, I'm even thinking about myself and me being in my 40s, you know. I mean, even I'm not sure I would even know what to do in a situation like that. So I never thought about it from that point of view. So now you have a 17-year-old who's in a situation who, you know, you're right, who just simply wouldn't know what to do or have the tools to pull from in order to get himself out of that situation. Never even thought about it that way.
Of course. And he's got someone who is obviously behaving in a role. Yes, it was imagined that this man thought that he was of some type of an authority. So it's conflicting because you've got someone pursuing, he's young, and he's got someone pursuing him. He's got a weapon, but he's not an authority. He's not an authority. It's very conflicting, and he just didn't have the time to even make a decision for his life, and no one was there to protect him.
What's amazing about this is if you drew the parallel between what just happened with this case and, let's say, it was a rape case, and we're talking about a 17-year-old girl,
which I've done crisis intervention.
Yeah, we wouldn't have this many questions about, what was her thought process? How come she was dressed a certain way?
Absolutely.
She would automatically be a 17-year-old girl.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
But it's like that's the interesting thing in the rally cries that come around this whole case are that a lot of people can relate to being thought of as an adult when they're really still a kid.
Not one.
I just substitute
because we have to look at what he was facing. Yeah.
And, I mean, there were kids that were seriously, like, almost 6 feet. Like, a couple of them had growth spurts. They're huge. You talk to them, they are still seventh graders, trust me.
Right. Absolutely. Yep.
Well, Gina,
now,
you gave us some.
Grown.
Yeah, but they're not. Yeah, Gina, I have to tell you, you very much enlightened me and gave me a different way of thinking about it because I assure you I had not thought about it that way. So, darling, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate you taking the time. That was really, really good conversation, very good conversation. And, you know, Nikki, when I think about it, you're right. If it was a 17-year-old girl and we're talking about rape, you know,
we wouldn't have
this really question. And like I said, what's interesting about what Gina said to me was, I at my age, you know, think about what I would do in a situation like that, and I'm not even clear on what I would do. So
we're expecting a 17-year-old to be clear on what he would do.
And I have a whole life experience pretty much about different things and been to places and here and there. But you're right, you know, we expected that a 17-year-old would have a point of reference on what it is that he should do. And it's interesting, Nikki, that you say that about kids when they have this sort of growth spurt, because there's a friend of mine, and her daughter is actually, now to look at her, you would think that this kid, I kid you not, is like in her mid-20s, but she's actually only 16 years old. So it's not until you literally start to talk to her and you have a conversation with her that you realize she's just a kid.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Now, flipping it on its side, you know, because I'm always trying to get both sides of the story, I'm sure we can also look at Zimmerman and look at him at being 28, extremely green with criminal justice, not completing anybody's program. He's green himself. Now, he's an adult no matter what, but he's still green in the whole law enforcement world, too. So he's not even on rookie status yet. So look at the decisions he made. I'm pretty sure he probably would do something different that night if he could go back. Hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah.
So rookie mistakes are made, but he just, you know, he's still an adult versus you have somebody who qualifies as a kid.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And, Gina, I just want to say again, thank you for, you know, bringing that whole point up and enlightening me. And I know Nikki and Grover, because during all of this that we've talked about, I've never thought about it in that way before. So I guess that's why it's good to have friends who are in the medical field, because they do look at things differently. But Grover, any last words or thoughts that you want to say before we get out of here and wrap it up tonight?
No, you know, it's definitely going to be an interesting case, just like the Casey Anthony case. It's just mind-blowing how many changes and different this case has a different way of going each and every day that I've seen it so far. It's going to be interesting, and definitely a lot of things are going to be changed here in the state. Florida, definitely with the Stand Your Ground, I can definitely see that being changed around and make that more specific as to when it should be used, especially in Stand Your Ground defense cases. The law enforcement issue aspect of it, you know, when you see like a shooting that's occurred, I think there's going to be more investigation behind the actual shooting than the perpetrator or the shooter that says, oh, well, it was just the underground. You know, I think the police officers, the law enforcement officers and detectives will actually look into the shooting a little bit deeper. And especially with this Trayvon Martin case, it's definitely going to show a lot of folks what this law actually can do and how harmful it can be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I definitely think you're right. Nikki, any last comments or thoughts?
Yeah, I want people to continue to follow this case, primarily because it starts a dialogue, really goes deeper. It's like the movie Crash. There's a lot of inherent things that happen in this world that people have perceptions. And if we talked about it instead of, you know, quietly humbled and mumbled about it, they might understand maybe something like the best perceptions and see that it lead to life or death situations. I can cover this stuff objectively all I want. The sad part, I'd like to have to cover this stuff. And ideally, if people would start having these dialogues amongst themselves, what are your anxieties about, put it there, what are your anxieties about young males, big or small? What are your anxieties about vigilante justice? How do you feel about this? Start having that dialogue, then maybe we can kind of put consensus, and then we can have less praise of teens.
Yeah, really, really good thought. Grover, thank you so much for calling in. I'm sure you'll be back on very soon, because crazy things just seem to follow you around and in that state that you live in.
Definitely.
Okay, and Nikki, I always appreciate your input, and you and I are kind of doing stuff behind the scenes. I'm trying to get up there to talk to the Association of Black Media Workers about the show on Blog Talk Radio, so I hope that we're able to work that out, because I would love to get there and talk to you guys about it.
Awesome, thank you.
All right, Nikki, thank you so much. And, guys, you know, you can always find Nikki on Facebook. Grover's on Facebook. In fact, both of them are on my wall. So if you are not friends with them, they're just fun people to follow. So they're, you know, very cool journalists, but they also have their own lives. So I just think it's fun to watch them and follow them on Facebook as well. Gina was super tonight. So Gina called in from California, gave us a shook up the entire show, gave us a whole different perspective on this whole Trayvon Martin case and his age being 17 and him perhaps on having a perspective to be able to reach and pull from and sort of trying to deal with the situation. So that really gave me food for thought. I want to thank Marilyn Bennett, our producer inside the chat room, did a wonderful time. Sandy was with us earlier from Nebraska. Sandy, I think, had some problems with the internet and ended up having to dump out. Mitch Cradle, a D.C. detective and very active in the community in Washington, D.C., I want to thank Mitch for being with us. All of our guests, also entertainment co-host Michael Kay, has been hanging out with us inside the chat room. Michael and I have a bunch of new shows that's coming up next week and the week after, so you know we will post that on Facebook if you guys are interested in continuing to follow us. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time. So no matter how this turns out, I certainly do think what Nikki said, there are a lot of lessons to be learned from this. So I think we'll, you know, it's sort of like a cherry tree. You can sort of pick different issues off of that tree and learn from all of those different types of issues. So I want to, again, thank Nikki, and I want to thank Grover so much for being here on At Home with Victoria. And thank you, and have a great, great night, everyone.
You have been listening to At Home with Victoria, a popular news and entertainment show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Plus, download the show on iTunes as a free podcast and like us on Facebook. Tune in again next time for At Home with Victoria with your host, Victoria Gaither.